The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Well, welcome to Breaking Banks. It's JP Nichols sitting in for Brett King this week. Brett is traveling. In fact, he was traveling last week, too, in Singapore and Hong Kong. So we have a handful of interviews that he picked up along the way that we're going to share with you. First, of course, our announcements. The Retail Banking Analytics Europe Conference is coming up in London on the 20th and 21st of June. As we usually do, we've got exclusive VIP discounts for Breaking Banks listeners. You can save £150 with the code BBVIP150. And you'll enter that code in their website at fc.bi.com/retailbanking. And we'll tweet that out, but one more time, it's fc-bi.com/retailbanking. Also, Next Bank is now known as Next Money, and the next conference coming up for Next Money is in New York on September 7th, right before Finovate. And the following week will be in London on September the 14th. Information about both of those shows are at nextmoney.org, the new website of Next Bank. And both of those shows also will be in partnership with the BBVA Open Talent Challenge. So our usual mix of panels and discussions and keynotes will also be mixed with some great startups competing for the BBVA Open Talent Challenge. A few things caught my eye in the news this week. We've talked a couple of times over the last couple of shows about LendingClub and some of the challenges that are happening not only to that company, but the marketplace lending segment. Of course, their CEO was forced to resign, and they've had some lending practices that haven't been handled very well. Some potentially good news coming out just this week. News that they've reached a handful of the hedge funds who may be able to provide some funding for them if they can do that and provide funding for those loans and make sure that the liquidity doesn't dry up. That would be good news indeed, not only for LendingClub, but for that whole space. And I think Ron Shevlin talked about this on the show a couple of weeks ago, and I agree with him. This is not the death knell. It's actually just a sign of growing up. So fintech goes beyond this hype and theory onto real stuff. And I think similar things are happening in the payment space. Some news that Currency is dying. Currency was a group of merchants that got together to do their own merchant processing outside of Apple Pay and some of the other things. Well, that seems to be dying just as MX did. And the same week, news comes out this week from the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference that Apple Pay now coming to the web. So not only using it on your mobile phone, but being able to use it for desktop purchases as much as you would PayPal or Pay by Amazon. So interesting things there as the banks make their own moves. Our friend Phil Ryan at bankinnovation.net reports that Chase is now the third bank to launch real-time payments on Clear Exchange. They joined U.S. Bank and one of the other banks that are live already, a couple more. I think Bank of America is the other one. And Capital One and Wells Fargo, not quite live yet, but getting there. So interesting things happening in the payment space and the marketplace lending space. And we've talked before about wealth management, small business. We've got some other stories we're working on that we'll catch up with you on those in coming weeks. So that's it for the news this week. Let's get into the interviews. As I mentioned, Brett has been on the road in Singapore and Hong Kong, and he's had the opportunity to sit down with some pretty interesting people. We'll also have a FinTech 5 coming up with Sam Mall in a few minutes. But first up, Brett caught up with Charles Green, founder and CEO of RFI Group.
Here in Singapore, and we're catching up with a few notable players in the fintech space right now. And I ran into Charles Green, who is, of course, the founder of RFI, a well-known, actually global research house now. So, Charles, tell us, first of all, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks very much, Brett, and thanks for talking to me.
Tell me, what is RFI and where are you based? What do you do?
So RFI is a global business intelligence firm, and what we do is we work exclusively in financial services, so across banking, payments, insurance, traditional incumbents, and the new challenger and fintech players. And at the heart of what we do, we talk to 400,000 consumers and about 60,000 corporates across 40 markets globally about financial services, about their changing usage and attitudes, and obviously, you know, the importance of digital is one of the key things that we look at.
And where are you based?
So I'm probably split between Sydney and London, which sounds a bit psychotic, but I probably spend about 60-70% of my time in Sydney and the rest of the time in London, stopping off at our Singapore office on the way across.
So if you were to look at those three markets, Australia, London and Singapore, how would you compare them in terms of their readiness for what is happening in fintech? Because they're all talking about the importance of fintech. How would you compare their readiness?
Yeah, so they're three really different markets which have had really different histories over the last 5 years. Obviously, Australia, the big banks in Australia and the economy as a whole, sort of didn't completely emerge unscathed from the financial crisis, the credit crisis, but they were relatively unscathed compared certainly to the North American banks and the UK banks. So they were able to invest a lot earlier, but then they've got a much smaller population. So the traditional banks there are actually quite far advanced on the sort of digital adoption curve, and there are some P2P lenders in the market and some marketplace lenders, but we're not really seeing a regulatory environment yet, despite some of the current government's attempts to speed things up, that's really encouraging what you would call the neobanks or the digital-only banks. Certainly nothing like the UK, where you've really got you've got massive political willpower and political capital behind it. You've got significant regulatory changes. I think when Metro got their banking license, they were the first new bank to get a license in the UK for 100 years. That's obviously significantly changed now, so there's this two-step process. And you've got Atom, Starling, Mondo, Tandem, they're all through the first part of the process, and they're all looking to complete the second part this year, which is necessary. I think in India last month, there were 11 new banking licenses just in that month alone granted, so that really needed to speed up. And then in Singapore, you've again got that same regulatory willpower, if you like, behind the fintech scene. But again, some very different dynamics to the market. But if you look at contactless, the payment mechanism, it's quite a similar sort of transition, whereas, you know, Australia's probably got the highest spend per contactless per capita, but it does only have 16 million adults. The UK is really, certainly in London with TfL, starting to grow that quite exponentially now. And then Singapore is probably slightly behind Australia, but certainly ahead of the UK with contactless and its adoption. And that's probably similar to what we're seeing with the potential uptake for digital-only banks, where you've got Australia's not quite saturated, but there's less opportunity there. There's definitely some opportunity in Singapore. The opportunity in the UK and Canada is another market we've just finished looking at. Number one app, not just banking app, but number one app in Canada at the moment. There's some massive opportunity in Canada as well. So of the developed markets, probably Singapore, UK and Canada are probably the most exciting.
Now, from a research perspective, by the way, TfL, Transport for London. From a research perspective, are there any significant differences, say, in terms of millennial adoptions of fintech services versus like the way they trust fintechs and tech companies versus banks? In China, we see right now BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent. These things are going off. And in fact, they have better trust, more trust than the local banks. How would you compare that in, say, London, Singapore and Australia in terms of startups and their credibility to gain customers and gain share against the incumbents?
Yeah, we actually looked at that December of 2015. So there's a stat floating around, I think it's from Cisco Systems, that 80% of millennials would trust, you know, Google, Amazon, Facebook to do their banking. So as, you know, as a research firm, we wanted to unpick that a little bit, because do you trust someone is slightly vague, but obviously very emotive statement. So we actually, we spoke to about 50,000 consumers across 25 markets, a nice mix of developed and emerging markets, and asked them, amongst other things, do you trust this organization to hold your personal information and maintain it securely, which is essential for banking? And we saw some quite significant differences just globally across all consumers without looking at markets or consumer segments. About 65% trust banks, about 50% governments, about 42% telcos, and about 38% internet companies and fintechs. When you split that out by millennials, there's a little bit of an uptick from 38% to sort of 42% trusting fintechs. Now, there's two ways of looking at every stats. That means that only 42% of millennials trust fintechs, or it means already 42% trust fintechs to do their banking. So either way of looking at it. But when you look at geographic differences, China, India, Indonesia, the Philippines, way ahead of the rest of the markets. If you take those four out, the global average plummets. And really the only two developed markets that are anywhere near 50% are Australia and the UK, both at 40% of millennials there trust internet companies and fintechs for their banking. Just behind them is sort of Canada and Singapore on about 35%. So, you know, good news, already 35 to 40% do trust fintechs, but the banks still have that and that trust and security at the moment in their favor.
So in terms of take up of fintech type services or mobile adoption in the payments arena and so forth, when you look at the markets we talked about, Singapore, Australia and the UK, is there a very definite line where we can say millennials definitely are early adopters of this technology and the baby boomers and Gen X are late adopters? Is there differences in those markets, or would you see synergies in terms of those behaviors?
Yeah, there are some key differences, and I think if you're just looking at targeting millennials with a digital-only proposition, you can get yourself into a bit of trap. If we look at the UK in particular, in most markets, there's other ones you just mentioned, Australia, Singapore, most other developed markets, we see really millennials are the early adopters, and then quite quickly when you get to sort of 35 and you move into Generation X, you see a tail off both in frequency of usage and in how comfortable they are, how much they still want to carry on using the branch, and then when you talk about appetite for a digital-only main bank or a digital-only banking provider, it tails off pretty quickly. It's really, you know, millennials are where you need to play. When you look at the UK market, you actually see when you move from the millennials to Gen X, you actually see an uptick both in usage of digital, in decline of branch usage, in how comfortable they are with a digital-only main bank, and how comfortable they will be in the future in a digital-only main bank. So it's level across all the demographic segments in the UK, but actually Gen X is stronger than the millennial segment, which is different to a lot of markets. And with everything going on from a regulatory perspective and all the different players that are, you know, they're getting banking licenses this year, means it's gonna be a pretty exciting time in the UK in retail banking for the next couple of years.
So one last question: Brexit or no?
Oh.
Yes or no?
No, you can't do a Brexit.
Okay, very good. So just to finish up, how can people find out about RFI and what are you doing over the next 12 months?
Yes, yeah, so rfintelligence.com has everything, and also if you just go to globaldigitalbanking.com, we've got a global series of events starting in London on June the 16th and running through the UAE and Singapore and other places for the rest of the year, where we're really just trying to bring together the incumbent banks like Lloyds, like Barclays, like DBS here, and the Tescos and the Metros and the Digibanks and also the fintechs, the Atoms, Starlings, Fido, Number 26. Bank Mobile. So trying to get all of them in a room and have a balanced debate about how we can create an ecosystem where the customer is at the heart of that ecosystem, having an amazing customer experience, because that's what banking is now about. It's the age of the consumer, and with banks and everyone playing in the space needs to understand that and work either individually or in partnership to achieve that.
And what brings you to Singapore tonight or today?
I'm here to see the launch of your new book, which I'm really excited about. So I'm looking forward to that.
Thanks for the plug. I'll even give you a signed copy.
Thanks very much. Look forward to it.
All right. Thanks. That's Charles Green from RFI. Check out rfintelligence.com for more information on some of their stuff. And don't forget those conferences coming up.
Great insight there from Charles Green on trust. I think it is important to look at those geographic differences and in the places where governments are more involved and more bullish on fintechs, I think that's a good thing because the trust goes up. Well, it's already time for our first break. So as always, we want to thank our sponsor, Temenos. Temenos is on the forefront of providing banking solutions to increase financial inclusion. Check them out at temenos.com, and we'll be right back with more Breaking Banks.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
Consult Hyperion is a boutique payments consultancy based in New York and London, which helps clients deal with the rapid changes happening in the payment space. We deal with EMV optimization, helping issuers, acquirers, and merchants deliver value from their EMV investments. We help with the technical challenges involved in the digital transformation of payments through tokenization and mobile devices, and with the business cases behind the development of future payment technologies such as the blockchain and instant payments. Come and find out more at www.chyp.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back to Breaking Banks. It's JP Nichols at the helm again this week. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Brett was traveling in Hong Kong and Singapore this past week, and he sat down in Hong Kong with Jennifer Zhu Scott, founder of Radian Partners, which focuses on investment planning.
Jennifer Zhu, welcome to this on-the-spot interview for Breaking Banks in Hong Kong. First of all, tell me a bit about yourself and about your company that you run here out of Hong Kong.
Thank you, Brad. Welcome to Hong Kong. Welcome back to Hong Kong, I should say. I am a co-founder of Radian Partners. We help family offices and high net worth individuals to do private investment. My partners cover renewables and AR, VR, and I cover fintech and media. So the main idea in Hong Kong is because, you know, it's one place that's very close to China. Obviously, it's a very big market, but also overall in Asia Pacific, there's a large amount of wealth and private investment side is very underserved. So we see the opportunities here, and particularly in my area, fintech is still in the early stage in Hong Kong, but there are a lot of opportunities that's not as overpriced as elsewhere.
So do you actually manage funds yourself, or you work to consult with family offices and funds?
our motto is a little bit different. It's not traditional fund. We believe the fund structure, actually, there's a lot of misalignment between LPs and GPs. So the model we do is members owning, they pay a membership fee, and we provide peer-to-peer learning. But at the same time, much like a fund, we have a deal flow, we advise, and LPs have a chance to say no to each investment. And for the investment go through, we execute based on, you know, deal by deal basis. So we think in this way, you know, from our point of view, and from investee and also LP, the investors are much more aligned.
So let's come back to the fintech space particularly. And what makes Hong Kong, do you think, competitive on a global basis or interesting as a fintech destination in Asia or around the world?
I think Hong Kong inherently has a lot of natural advantages. For example, you know, Hong Kong has been a regional financial hub for a long time, not so much on the tech side, but in terms of understanding financial markets, there are a ton of talents have been living in Hong Kong. Given that a lot of banks and funds, you know, they don't pay the same as before 2008, but there's still a lot of people, a lot of professionals in financial industry. They love Hong Kong. They don't want to leave in Hong Kong. I personally know a lot of those people ended up starting companies. So a problem they used to suffer when they work in big institutions. I think, you know, also Hong Kong is a truly global city. It's obviously a gateway into China. It's right next to Shenzhen. You know, not so much in fintech, but in terms of hardware, you know, business, startup in Hong Kong, they have this advantage. You can make prototype very, very easily right next to Shenzhen. So there are many unique advantages in Hong Kong, but also it's the only Chinese city where you have rule of law. You have very sophisticated legal system, accounting system, etc. So it's quite difficult to compete in that sense. However, having said that, I think Hong Kong suffer from lack of technical talents and lack of mechanism to import technical talents. Some of the best coders and programmers are actually Indians and Pakistanis, but it's almost impossible for them to get a visa in Hong Kong. Talents from Shenzhen, you know, their price is very high and they don't need to come to Hong Kong because the market in China is much bigger. So we
had a visit up to Shenzhen the other day and we did some interviews with some robotics guys and working on deep learning and AI and, things like visual learning matrices for artificial intelligence. So it seems there's this really interesting sort of grassroots technology movement emerging in Shenzhen. How would you compare the sort of innovation that's occurring there with the innovation we see, say, coming out of Silicon Valley?
I am really impressed by what's happening in Shenzhen right now. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, I'm on the funding committee of Shenzhen International Innovation Institute. We are going to build an institute that cater for all youth. You know, there's no degree, but we basically teach them all the skills, the soft and hard skills, to prepare them to become very innovative entrepreneurs. I think, you know, the most important characteristic of a lot of this innovative business in China is that they're very domestic. Compared to Silicon Valley, I think in US it's also quite domestic, but by nature, a lot of American companies, it's not too difficult for them to expand into Europe or rest of the world. But for a lot of companies in China, for many reasons, it's always domestic. They can be big enough just by being Chinese company. But in the coming decades, I would really love to see some company can break that barrier, become truly global company, but we're not there yet.
So I want to change tack a little bit here, Jennifer. So you're a real leader here in Hong Kong in the fintech space, and you do a lot of speaking in media and so forth. But, you know, what does it take to be a strong female leader in the technology space in Hong Kong? And how would that compare, say, to the opportunities that, you know, strong women might have in other parts of the world, do you think?
I think, first of all, I think, you know, to promote diversity is to take out the category. I think when you promote diversity, it's much more important to build incentive. For example, I know quite a lot of funds, VC funds in the U.S., they invest companies have female co-founders or funders. And McKinsey has reported that this kind of company consistently outperform companies, you know, purely funded by male. And I think it's a mistake for a lot of STEM class only for girls, because, you know, I think it's not very constructive when you single out the gender. You know, we're all just human beings. We love science. We want to be in this field and we're good at it. We happen to be female. So my mentality is not to consider myself as female first. So my mentality is I'm as qualified as everybody else, and I happen to be a female, and just like you happen to be a male. I think, you know, being a female, having said that, I think being a female professional in Hong Kong, in Greater China, there are a lot of advantages. You know, I think you can blame Mao for many mistakes, but one thing he did was he really forced to make male and female absolutely equal, which I don't think is necessarily right, but you will find in China it's much more acceptable when a female is leading a large company than in the US, for example. And in Hong Kong, one thing very practical about being female busy professional is that, you know, we're very lucky to have such affordable, capable domestic care, domestic help. And, you know, I have two young children. All I need to do is to spend quality time with them. And for the rest of the time, I can work on my career. And my husband works as well. And I think, you know, that liberated the many female in Hong Kong, same as in Singapore as well. And I would say, you know, for a lot of talented female professionals in Hong Kong, you know, one thing really stopping them from become leader in their field is their mental status, you know, where their mentality is, nothing else.
So we see a lot of noise coming out of Singapore right now about fintech and what's going to happen, you know, in terms of making Singapore a fintech leader in the world. And there's always been a little bit of healthy competition between Singapore and Hong Kong. But what do you think Hong Kong needs to do to really capitalize on this opportunity to be a future fintech leader?
First of all, I think Hong Kong and Singapore can be complementary to each other. And I like healthy competition, but I don't think it's very productive for the region constantly comparing with each other. I hear the same argument between Shanghai and Hong Kong as well. Those cities would never be the same. They would never function the same. They would never completely replace each other. I think Singapore, the government is doing a tremendous job, and they're very active, they're very nimble, they're very decisive. This is something Hong Kong is lagging behind many, many years. And I'm not very optimistic in terms of how the government will be able to act very quickly to change that kind of structure and mentality. Having said that, you know, you spend a few days here in Hong Kong, you have seen there are still a lot of fintech companies want to stay in Hong Kong. I had many conversations, you know, every, you know, entrepreneurs, they say Singapore government, they give them all this space, you know, matching funding. I say, you know, if Singapore is so great, why are you still in Hong Kong? And they say, well, the market is much bigger. So I think it's a trade-off. You know, depends on what you do. You either in Hong Kong or Singapore. I don't think the two cities should try to fight who's the bigger global fintech center. As you have seen travel around the world, you know, the entire world has been decentralized just because of democratization of information, of infrastructure. I think, you know, the future is you will see many, many different fintech centers. And I think Hong Kong, Singapore probably will be quite outstanding, and also Shenzhen could be outstanding centers in Asia. But there's no one city will take it all.
Great. So if people want to check out what you're doing and keep in touch with some of your thinking, How can we follow you on social media or find what you're doing with Radium Partners?
Thank you. I tweet, so my Twitter account's at Jen Drew Scott. And also you can check out our website, radiant.partners. We're doing something quite new, quite different. And hopefully we can make some impact in this space. Thank you.
Great. Jennifer Zhu, thanks for joining Breaking Banks.
Thank you very much, Brad. Have a good trip home.
Now it's time for our FinTech 5 with Sam Mall. This week, Sam's guest is Nicole Sturgill, Principal Executive Advisor, Retail Banking at CEB.
Welcome back to the FinTech 5. This is our continuing series. In each episode, I speak with FinTech founders, innovators, and I literally put them on the clock. Today's guest is Nicole Sturgill. I said her name right. She's a Principal Executive Advisor. What a great title. In retail banking at CEB. How are you doing?
I am well.
You're not allowed to touch any buttons on this phone.
Sorry.
Okay. Tough limits. All right, you ready?
It's just so fancy. I couldn't help myself.
iPhone 6 Plus. All right, you ready?
I am ready.
5 minutes starts now. Tell us a little about your role at CEB and what you do.
So what I do at CEB is I work with banks and financial technology companies, working with the banks to figure out what their issues are, help them understand the issues, work with the technology providers, kind of act as that translator about what the banks are looking for. We really, I say, three pillars: consumer research, where we're asking end customers what they want to do or what they care about when banking. We ask the banks what they're doing, and there's some bank benchmarking. And then we work with the technology providers to find out what's in the market, what's happening, follow the traditional kind of long-time fintech providers and the new ones.
And I'm curious, when you talk to the consumer side, because what a unique concept. Talk to the people that use products. Do you do that geographically specific? I mean, how do you approach that when you're working with banks?
Yeah, we're generally, we do a customer experience survey, and we do it every couple of years. So it's not that we're, you know, it's not a constant, but we do this kind of massive survey asking about what channels they like to use, what kind of service they get, how they like to open accounts, do they use social media? It's this, you know, wide array of questions. And we do that over generally about 10 to 12 countries, usually about 500 to 1,000 people in each country. And then we can put that into regional information, pull country-specific information, and then depending on who we're talking to and who we're working with, we'll pull the data that's going to be most important to them and is going to help them drive their strategy.
How long have you been with CEB?
I have been here, it'll be 8 years in May.
Oh, that's a good haul.
Yeah.
What were you doing prior to that? What was your background?
So I spent my first 10 years at Fifth Third Bank in Cincinnati.
So you've been in the industry.
I've been on the other side of the table. That's where I started. I started by working at a bank for 10 years, started in commercial banking, which was pretty funny. I was a psych major, so my first day when
Perfect
they said, you'll be in commercial, I said, what is commercial? And then moved over into operations, managed ATM operations, debit operations, Reg E, all those fun things for 10 years. And throughout the 10 years, and then moved to London for personal reasons. My husband was going to grad school. I worked for a company called Transoft, which is now part of NCR. So it was great working for them in Europe. Every country is different in how they manage cash, so that was a lot of fun.
What surprises you the most with what's going on right now in retail banking today? That's a loaded question, but what do you look at and go, I just didn't see that coming?
Yeah, I would say that the thing that has surprised me has been within the institutions themselves, how hard it is to bring innovation. So,
oh God,
it's so
true.
And it isn't just the technology, but the culture. You got to change your culture.
Isn't that funny? Because everyone wants to jump right to the tech.
Yeah.
Because the tech is there, but it gets back to people.
Right. And we get the question all the time: who should I buy from? Who should I partner with? And unless you have an organization that is ready to work with these new companies, bringing in new technology, providing new services to customers, it's not going to work. So really focusing on the inside of the bank and how much that has to change, I think that's probably the part that I work in technology. I work with that all the time, and I jump to the technology too. What I have found is that for the banks, it's the culture that they really need to focus on to make that work.
Yeah, I'm not shocked at that at all, that it still comes back to people, you know? We might be augmented, Brett, because I know you love that, but it's still going to come back to people. All right, we're down to the rapid fire. We got a minute to go. I'm going to throw out questions. Top of your head. Can't think. Okay?
Scary.
Oh, this, okay. This will be real easy. What's the most overused buzzword in fintech?
Omnichannel.
Oh, that's a good answer. Where do you live?
New Orleans.
How long have you lived in New Orleans?
9 months.
So where'd you live prior to that?
New York.
So there couldn't be a bigger shift. What's it like? What's the difference between living in New York and New Orleans?
Well, I thought that the Big Easy was, I don't know, some silly slogan. What I have learned is that living in New Orleans is much easier. Everything is easier. Everyone's laid back. Time is more of a guideline than a rule. Fits me perfectly. You can't use north, south, east, west because the city is curved. I don't know direction, so it's perfect.
So completely different than New York, right?
Absolutely.
Just count the streets and go.
Absolutely.
If you could name three fintech companies to watch.
Ooh. SoFi. Absolutely. Braintree, continue to watch. And I continue to watch Simple. I find them doing some really interesting things.
That's a good broad answer. I like that. All right, that's about it. That's all the time we have for. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where can we learn more about you and the work you're doing?
CEBglobal.com. I'm in the financial services practice, and so you can see bio there and some of the work that we do, and I'm on Twitter at N Sturgill.
Yeah, definitely follow her. Good Twitter account. All right, thank you so much. Throwing it back over to you.
Thanks, Sam and Nicole. They talk about culture and how important that is, and I couldn't agree more. It's not just about the technology. Technology is ubiquitous. It's really about having the culture that embraces that and moves it forward. So it's time for another break, and we'll be right back after this message.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick Award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Consult Hyperion is a boutique payments consultancy based in New York and London, which helps clients deal with the rapid changes happening in the payment space. We deal with EMV optimization, helping issuers, acquirers, and merchants deliver value from their EMV investments. We help with the technical challenges involved in the digital transformation of payments through tokenization and mobile devices, and with the business cases behind the development of future payment technologies such as the blockchain and instant payments. Come and find out more at www.chyp.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Okay, to wrap up Breaking Banks today, we've got one last interview that Brett did with a robotics company in Hong Kong called Seven Senses Lab. They're employing robotics to aid in children's education. They've got some very interesting applications for blockchain. So here's Brett with Raj Sodhi, CEO of Seven Senses Lab.
Hi, so I'm Brett King from Breaking Banks radio show. Raj, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Brett. Appreciate it.
Tell me first of all, introduce yourself and tell me about the company you've got here in Shenzhen.
Sure. So I'm Raj Sodhi, CEO of Seven Senses Labs, and what we're doing is we want to disrupt the education space, specifically in the area of personalizing education for early learning, making education much more impactful and emotionally engaging for starting with young children moving up the stack.
Now, why Shenzhen? Because you're originally from Chicago, you're telling me. So what brings you all the way to China to develop technology in robotics and application of this technology for early learning?
So I've been coming to China for 25 years. It's always been an attraction to me. It's where things get adopted, often innovative, and then it perseveres across globally. Came to China because, one, it's an interesting opportunity. I found a lot of the things back in 2008 in the U.S. Quite honestly boring, and the momentum has shifted towards the East, and I came to China, started off working for Oracle for a couple of years, running product management, and then moving into running my own startup again, my third startup, now focusing on education, but in the area of hardware, the convergence of hardware and software, where we bring in AI to add some intelligence and communication to that model.
So tell me specifically about some of the products you have that you guys are working on, and you know, are you working on actually robots for the classroom, or what is the tech you guys are working on?
So we are, our model is B2C and B2B. So what that means is we have strategic channel partners that offer our product online and offline. And we also have a model for going towards B2B with partners in that have access to schools. And the difference being, on a side note, with China is that it's a top-down approach. So when you have people that believe in what you're doing and there's a mandate from government to do something such as coding in the classroom and you offer a compelling solution, they will tend to adopt it. And it all comes down to the relationships, showing measurement and performance to the teachers and the parents, and also giving making it affordable for the masses, because that's our vision and approach, is we want to make learning fun yet affordable for everybody who needs it.
So tell me about, at Seven Sense Labs, what is the product that you're selling?
So we it's pretty funny, when we talk about our robot and our AI, there's actually three companies or three products that are being put together. One is the robot, actually the hardware itself, and then we have the software, which is kind of like its operating system, and the integration with apps, such as like learning apps, educational apps that are like math-based, science-based, language acquisition. And then we've got the AI, which is the computer vision, the speech recognition, and the machine learning. And when you have all those three together, you can have a smart companion that makes it really interesting and compelling for young kids, because they often forget it's actually a physical toy or a robot or a machine. They consider it one of their friends.
So it's a companion robot designed to help teach in either the home or in the classroom.
Yes, so it's a physical robot that is a delivery mechanism we're using to take children through the process of learning, reciting, practicing, and sharing, so they can actually it's like a hands-on experiential approach that we want to give children. But this is only a delivery model. The real interesting part is on all the data that we're able to provide parents and teachers on how their children are performing, so the parents and teachers can actually be more proactive rather than waiting to see how the results of kids are appearing. So if they have challenges, let's tackle them on the onset versus later on when you're 6 months later in a term.
So you talk about AI and machine learning and for the companion robot. So what capabilities, what is it learning, what is it watching for, what observations is it making as it's going about its day?
So what we intend to do is offer what we call a narrowband AI. And that basically means it's just the inverse of like Siri or Cortana. It's essentially providing a very focused approach to what the robot understands and how the robot provides feedback. So if you're learning language, it will understand a certain set of grammar that that is specific to what children in that age group are communicating about in their, either in the household or a classroom. So one of the initiatives we're focusing on is bringing to market, creating a community, actually, whether it's competitors or otherwise. We think that there's a lot of room for cooperation to make narrowband AI much more relevant for the end user rather than something like a Siri, which is very broad.
And you were telling me that you're actually looking at integrating the blockchain in part of this technology. So where would you apply the blockchain in education and AI, you know, companion robots in the classroom?
So for we have some strategic partnerships with the studios in Hollywood, and they have a lot of trust in what we do, the content we deliver and the means we deliver in, the security means. But so that also means we need to ensure transparency. And we need to provide a complete audit trail. So blockchain allows us through smart contracts to have the ability to show ongoing basis the usage of the content, how it's delivered, how often it's used, how often it's viewed, how much money is being paid. And so the whole chain is provided. That's one model. The second model is we have a partner which will be yet unnamed right now that will serve as a third-party validator. And what we intend to do is offer a education blockchain mediator that would not only serve for auditing transactions, but also for authentication. So ensuring that the data of the children and the other end users are protected. And therefore, I think blockchain and areas like a blockchain can be quite important to the business, especially coming from and dealing with standards in the banking industry for the last 20 years, I think we can definitely apply that experience to where we need to go with AI and robotics.
So what flavor of blockchain are you using? Are you guys working with Ethereum, or what for smart contracts, that's pretty hot at the moment. So what's the blockchain that you're bringing to bear?
So I have Chris Kier here with me, who's our general counsel, but he's also a blockchain nerd, I can call it. And He's from Florida, but he's been working with Ethereum, and we are exploring Ethereum with a certain third-party partner that's very well known to create a test bed with certain other partners from the content standpoint to create a sandbox where we can deploy and do some initial testing with.
Yeah, we just interviewed Vitalik Buterin on the show like 3 weeks ago. Ethereum's pretty hot right now.
He'll actually kill me for doing this without him here. So.
Okay, well, we can get to him later. So, so how long have you been in Shenzhen?
I've been in Shenzhen almost 4 years.
And how would you compare the environment of Shenzhen in terms of incubation and creation of these new startups compared with, say, something like Silicon Valley or Silicon Alley in New York?
So I've never been in, well, I have, I've been in Ideal Lab and in Pasadena back in the late 90s with Bill Gross, and we were the initiators of the incubation program. And Ideal Lab was really the home of, we do 60 startups at a time and have a 6-week program here in Shenzhen. I think it's a good and bad. They have incubators in every corner, just like they have McDonald's. I can't say that each one offers any kind of value, real perceived value, beyond just having a co-working space. There are some, like here at SAG, they provide machines that allow us, we can use those machines. And they also bring, for us, they bring students and kids to give us good observation points. So for us, there's a certain relevancy, and also it's a good sourcing place for going downstairs to get components. That's something you can't get in the Valley, and you definitely can't get in New York.
So describe the building we're in now for people who are listening to the show in New York. Tell me about the building that the incubation sits on, the 12th floor up here, but what else is happening below us here?
I compare it to, what is that movie, Chocolate Factory? Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So it's kind of like that. You get lost when you go downstairs because you've got millions of vendors that are selling all these different components at a tenth of the price you probably pay in the U.S., And though I'm not promoting this to all the foreigners that want to come to Shenzhen, it's not for everybody, hint, hint, but it is a place that if you can get by with the language and you know what you're looking for, you can probably build anything here.
Now, I've heard that amongst in the culture of the hackers and the startup communities here in Shenzhen, there's a type of new currency developing, which is that people get credibility from inventing new ideas and utilizing tech in different ways. Are you familiar with this sort of street currency that's emerging between hackers and builders and makers?
It's not enough yet. So in terms of, there's still a lot of, I would say, copying happening. There's not enough innovation, and I think there's a lot more Western influence that needs to come into China to change that complexion, because that's still the complexion. And so when you do have spaces like this, one of the challenges we do have when we're doing hardware is the privacy. And I'm American, so I will tell it how it is. So privacy is definitely a factor. Most Chinese firms don't understand the importance of privacy. And that's something that has to be taught. And that's something that we, if we have time, that's something we can teach. But it has to come from the government and support like that.
Cool. Thanks, Raj.
Thank you. And I just want to introduce Chris. We were talking about blockchain.
Hey, Chris. I'm Brett King. So I run a couple of radio shows out of New York, Life in the Smart Lane, and also Breaking Banks, which is a fintech disruption. It's actually the largest fintech radio show in the world. We have 1.5 million listeners in 72 countries. And we just had Vitalik Buterin on the show 3 weeks ago, who you probably know. So I'm very interested in your use of the blockchain and what applications you see for smart contracts. So can you introduce yourself, and then I'll ask you specifically about how you're using blockchain. He gave an answer, but you might be able to give a little bit more detailed answer. All right. So I'll just introduce yourself first and wait for me to give you the microphone, and then I'll ask you what potential you see for blockchain and the application of robotics and so forth. All right. So. Introduce yourself first.
My name is Chris Keir. I'm a lawyer from the United States, and I'm with Raj in Shenzhen. Joined his team at Seven Senses Labs, and I'm working as its general counsel as it expands internationally. And I'm also helping Raj look into emerging technologies that may be able to help us transform education.
So do you think that there's big potential for the use of smart contracts and technologies like that when we're talking about self-learning machines, robots, AIs that are transferring information back and forward to each other, particularly, for example, if it was progress of a student in terms of how their language capability is going or their scholastic record?
Well, I mean, our first look at these kind of technologies is more for authentication and also... when we're working with content partners worldwide, we can actually, they're going to need to verify, how much of their content was used, when it was used. Many times you'll see foreign companies that are licensing technology or licensing other intellectual property into China to get, they'll get a percentage of revenue. But how do you audit that? How do you prove, how often that content was used? And so we're also looking at, possibly blockchain for auditing purposes.
Is there any particular flavor of blockchain that you're looking at right now?
There are a couple. I know that Intel recently created it's more for like developers to explore blockchain using the Intel platform. So we're looking at that one. But at this stage, it's still pretty exploratory because, blockchain, it's a very hot topic right now. And,
it's smoking hot topic,
it's
dude.
It's a very hot topic, but, so it's kind of like, if you have a hammer, everything becomes a nail. So does blockchain necessarily make sense to apply to it? That's what we need to determine first.
So where in the States are you from?
Florida.
And what has brought you all the way across to Shenzhen? Why Shenzhen? What's special about Shenzhen?
Well, I arrived here about 7 years ago, and at the time, I really knew nothing about it. I was traveling through China. I'd read a little bit about Shenzhen on Wikipedia, and I didn't know anything about the hardware scene, didn't know anything about its technology scene. It just happened to be close to Hong Kong and was less expensive than Hong Kong, so... That was what initially brought me here, and then,
But do you guys think that it's that combination of hardware, component availability, sort of the availability of incubation spaces, and now building a code base with AI and other things like that, is that sort of all coalescing to make Shenzhen a sort of an interesting center for innovation in Asia?
I think it's a great place, and I heard a little bit of your conversation with Raj before, and that what's amazing about Shenzhen is speed. It's the speed with which you can really implement your ideas. You know, if you're making a prototype and say one part's not working, you can go right downstairs and replace it. You can innovate very, very fast here. And there is this ecosystem that's kind of built up around it. Not only do you have makers and tech people here, but you also have lawyers, you have venture capitalists, you have international distribution here. So it's really, kind of all coalesced so that somebody can have this idea to make something and they can really make it happen very, very quickly.
So two challenges actually I can share. One is the internet connectivity. So if you are a Western company, I'm an entrepreneur as well, so I've got to be realistic too. It also keeps the competition away. That's a good thing. So you got to have a sense of humor. But one of the things is internet connectivity. You got to be realistic. So yes, speed of market is fast here because the speed is very fast. I think it's on steroids compared to even Silicon Valley. But the thing is internet connectivity, and also if you're doing AI. A lot of the frameworks don't work here just because some of the services are blocked. So you have to think about really how you want to approach AI, and a lot of the partner services just don't work here. So
you mean like AWS?
AWS is very slow. Google services are dead. You just need to really decide where on a stack you're playing with AI.
Raj and Chris, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for another week of Breaking Banks. So thanks again to all of our listeners and to our sponsor, Temenos, for making this happen. And we'll see you all next week on the next Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.